Hello, thank you for joining me for episode 10 of the Sleep to Healthy podcast titled Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia. I'm Dennis Trumpy, and my goal is to help improve your sleep for your better health and well-being. Many years ago, I struggled with anxiety and depression. I'm thankful for the counselors and the resources available to help me dig my way out of that dark hole. One of the most impactful tools was a book called Feeling Good by Dr. David Burns. I thought the title was a little hokey, but the content was profound. It was a book about cognitive behavioral therapy, a topic we will explain in a minute. But even more helpful was the Feeling Good Handbook, a book that took the teachings and converted it into easy-to-follow exercises. Since then, I've preferred self-help books that include exercises to put theory into action. So you can probably understand my enthusiasm when I came across the Insomnia Workbook, a comprehensive guide to getting the sleep you need, by Dr. Stephanie Silverman. Here was a book that gave fundamental principles of insomnia and then added exercises to turn the knowledge into action and decisions. Dr. Silverman is a clinical psychologist and board-certified sleep medicine specialist, a fellow of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, but also a working mother, wife, and community activist. Dr. Silverman, welcome to this episode of the Sleep to Healthy podcast.
Hi there.
In your practice, you regularly help people improve their sleep. Can you give us an example where someone really struggled with getting a good night's sleep, but was able to work their way out of it?
Sure. Well, this is certainly what I see on a daily basis in my practice. And one person I can think of in particularly that was a really wonderful success story is named Carrie. And she was a 38-year-old woman who came to see me after the birth of her first son. So she'd reported that, you know, she was exhausted during the day, basically doing everything that a new mother is doing. And she absolutely could not understand why, despite her complete and total exhaustion, she was getting into bed at night and her mind was still going, her thoughts were racing, and she would lie there feeling completely wide awake. So unfortunately, she went and sought some other treatment before coming to me and ended up being prescribed some medication for sleep. And this led to her becoming dependent on them. So by the time she came to me, she was physically and psychologically dependent on sleeping pills. And she desperately wanted to get off of them. She'd already now been taking them for several years. Her child was actually already in preschool. She had much more time during the day to get things done. And she couldn't understand why she was still having quite the level of insomnia that she did. So we certainly went through all of the behavioral aspects of what was going on with her, things like cutting out caffeine late in the day, making sure she was getting enough exercise, enough mental challenges during the day for herself, and finding a good balance in her life. And through the treatment, she was able to come down off of all of the sleeping medication. We did that slowly together so that she would not have such a extreme reaction to coming down. And we did that, you know, slowly together. And she really adhered well to this type of treatment protocol, which involved restricting the amount of time that she was in bed, making sure she wasn't doing things in bed that she shouldn't, like reading or watching TV in bed, or actually being on her phone, which was a big issue for her because she spent a lot of time on her phone when she couldn't sleep. So she was so happy, and really she came in and it took her 5 sessions in total to come down off of the sleeping pills and be able to sleep very well without any sleeping aids. So that's just an example of how wonderful and effective this type of treatment is. But she was very devoted and really participated actively in her treatment.
Yeah, it is a treatment that takes, as you say, dedication and sometimes sacrifice and commitment to make it work. And I'm glad you brought up that as an example. I'm hoping that one of the future episodes we can focus on new mothers and sleep, because I know that's a particular issue for them. Now, CBTI is a non-pharmaceutical option for improving sleep, and you are a sleep medicine specialist. And in the book, there's a whole chapter on medications for insomnia. What can you tell us about the role of medication and CBTI?
So medication for sleep is really intended to be short term. And the problem is that that's not how it's currently being used. So, for example, a person that is in a very high time of stress and perhaps is not able to start doing the CBT type of treatment might seek out a prescription for medication at that point. And that would be an appropriate time if it was considered short term. And the reason for that is that the sleeping medications cause dependency. So once you get started on them, it can be very difficult for people to just stop taking the meds on their own. They'll experience worse sleep when they try to stop. It's called actually insomnia rebound or rebound insomnia. So it'll just be worse at first, an exacerbation of the insomnia. And, you know, that usually means that they grab the pill again, because after a couple of nights of that, it's pretty difficult to do it on your own. And people think, I'm never going to be able to get off these pills. See, I do need them. And so they just go right back to taking them. So again, it can be something useful for the short term, but it's not taking care of the actual problem of what's maintaining the insomnia. And that's what CBT does.
The book can be viewed as a self-help book, but I don't think this means that the help of a sleep professional is being discouraged. Can you tell us how you intended your book to be used?
Oh, yeah. So I really, when I was writing this book, I actually was thinking of the fact that there are very few professionals that have this particular specialization. So yes, there's plenty of clinical psychologists out there, and there are plenty of sleep medicine docs. However, the vast majority of clinical psychologists do not have any training in sleep. And the vast majority of sleep docs actually are treating more conditions like sleep apnea, narcolepsy, more physical types of sleep disorders. So when I was writing this book, I was really trying to help individuals who might not be anywhere near a sleep psychologist and might not be able to get that CBTI treatment that they need. But also, it can work very much so, can be like an aid and a tool for psychologists, for example, that don't have that training but want to work with patients together. So I have gotten feedback that that's helpful as well for psychologists who can't refer to someone like a sleep psychologist, but they want to be able to help their patients. They do refer to the book and try to work through it together.
Yeah, I know for myself, when I've sought help, I've always found it better to be informed and to go into the sessions with a bit of background and some questions, and also to better understand what the person helping me is trying to explain to me.
For sure. Yeah, I was just going to say, on that note, people that do come in with the book tend to have much more rapid progress, as you can probably imagine, because they are informed and they know what we're going to be doing, and they have really insightful and good questions to ask.
In your book, you give some excellent background of the fundamentals of sleep and insomnia. But from a self-help perspective, it does focus on cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. Can you first explain what cognitive behavioral therapy is?
So cognitive behavioral therapy is focusing on both the cognitions, or the thoughts, and the behaviors that a person has that are causing any level of distress. So for a person, for example, with anxiety, it's going to be targeting both the thoughts that a person might have, which might be irrational in nature, for example, or quite negative, going to be finding other ways to think about certain situations or problems that they might be experiencing in their life, and change cognitive distortions as well. So the cognitive component is that, and the behavioral is really things that a person is doing that are maintaining the stressor, or in the example of anxiety, that's maintaining that level of stress and tension that the person has. So that's why it's targeting both areas.
So can you talk a bit about cognitive distortions in the thoughts, beliefs, and actions?
Sure. So when it comes to sleep, people often have a lot of cognitive distortions. For example, a person may believe that they absolutely need 8 hours of sleep per night to feel rested and restored. However, that is just really at this point almost a random number, because we have so many studies showing that that's not the case for individuals. Every single person has different sleep needs, and it should be based on how a person feels. So the example of that and how you would confront it would be to show a person that if they slept 6 hours solid at night without any medication, how did they feel during the day? And if a person tells you, well, actually, I'm feeling really good and I have a high amount of energy and I'm not lagging off at the end of the day, then you're able to address that cognitive distortion that they don't need that certain number. And that's just an example. There's obviously so many different types of cognitive distortions that people have, but it's about going in and finding the actual evidence that exists for or against that distortion and then being able to rework it.
How would you like to be the first to know when each episode is released, to get a summary of the podcast and advice on how to incorporate good sleep habits into your life? Go to sleeptohealthy.com at your earliest convenience and sign up to our newsletter next time you are on your web browser. Yeah, I remember that approach where you take something that you believe and then you look for, you know, facts, like almost like a scientific investigation of whether or not what you believe is true or not, and then being able to kind of reassemble your thought process. And what about that relationship between thoughts and feelings? Can you explain that a bit as well?
So it's really interesting, but I like to think of it as a circle. So it also, you're talking about thoughts and feelings you asked about, but also behaviors combine in there as well. So the way you're thinking about something is obviously going to be impacting how you feel. So if you have a more negative perspective during the day, then when something happens, you're going to feel more down about it. And you're going to cognitively be interpreting it one way, and it will come across as also feeling sadder about it or feeling more upset. And then that leads to the person having particular behaviors that maintain this circle. So they might say, yeah, you know, I didn't feel like anybody was really listening or responding to me when I went out. So next time I'm just not going to even go. So now they're backing away and their behaviors have changed. And because the person has backed away and is maybe being, for example, more socially isolated, now again, the thought process is, well, see, I was right about this and nobody wants to be with me. And it leads to this whole cycle back and forth. So really the nuts and bolts of CBT in many instances is to just find somewhere to cut in that circle. So you can cut in at the behaviors and make changes there. You can cut in with the thoughts. It's pretty hard to cut in with the feelings because those come from the both, the other components. So once changes are made, either through the thoughts or through the behaviors, then a person's feelings will start to change.
And originally, cognitive behavioral therapy was really focused on helping people with depression or anxiety. Why was there a need to create a branch of CBT specifically for insomnia?
So the thing about sleep is that there's so many different sleep disorders. I mean, in the International Classification of Sleep Disorders, there's over 85 different sleep disorders listed. And so it's really important for a person to actually have training on sleep, because you don't want to come in when a person presents to you and immediately just give the same treatment each time, saying, well, okay, you're saying you can't fall asleep, this is what we're going to do. You have to be able to rule out a lot of other sleep disorders as well, or also focus on how they may be causing the insomnia. So that's one reason, first of all, that it branched off, because it really is a very in-depth field, and it's a fascinating field because you have pulmonologists, neurologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, internists, family medicine docs, all doing sleep medicine that can get boarded in it. So it's really wonderful and how multifaceted it is. So that is why really it branched off and people specialize specifically in the treatment of insomnia and why we call it CBTI. That's actually the CBTI component has actually come about even while I've been practicing. We didn't originally even call it that. We just said CBT, but now that's everyone calls it CBTI because it is very specifically focusing on areas like a person's behaviors around sleep. So for example, their sleep hygiene, things that they can do during the day that will help promote positive sleep at night. And then of course, things at nighttime, like getting up out of bed when they don't sleep, controlling anxiety, practicing relaxation exercises. So these are all components of CBTI. And it was just really important for the field to be somewhat separated out because there are so many different sleep disorders.
So that's a good question. So what types of sleeping problems or sleep disorders is CBTI especially effective with?
So certainly for sleep onset or sleep maintenance, insomnia, so trouble falling asleep, and trouble staying asleep. It's really helpful for circadian rhythm disorders. So people that have either a delayed sleep phase or an advanced sleep phase, in other words, their biological clock is just sort of off with regard to society. So someone with the delayed sleep phase is going to be like that typical teenager or early 20s that falls asleep at 4 or 5 in the morning. But once they fall asleep, they're good to go. They can sleep 8 hours. But this isn't really very conducive to jobs, school, etc. And then also the advanced sleep phase, you tend to see more commonly in the elderly population. And this is when you're talking about a person who might fall asleep at 8 p.m. and sleep until 4. And then they're really upset because they're up at 4 in the morning, but you know, they've just had 8 hours of sleep. So CBT is really effective for circadian rhythm disorders, for insomnia. And there are a lot of behavioral sleep disorders that children have that it's very effective for as well.
Okay, so I'd like to actually go over some of the main components of CBTI. So why don't we start with sleep hygiene? What can you tell us about sleep hygiene?
Well, sleep hygiene is just really focusing on good behaviors surrounding sleep. So here we're talking about recommendations like exercising, about 4 to 5 hours before bedtime is sort of ideal for sleep, or any time earlier in the day, making sure the exercise is not really late at night and right before bed. Limiting caffeine, I tell people no caffeine for 12 hours before bedtime. Other aspects of sleep hygiene would be making sure that the sleep environment is quiet, dark, comfortable temperature for sleeping, and that activities are not occurring in the bed that are too stimulating. So for example, looking at electronics at night, reading or watching TV, if those are stimulating activities for the person. I mean, if your mind is quite active at night while doing those activities, then it's best to be doing them elsewhere, like in a comfy chair or on the couch, but not actually in bed. So those are some components of sleep hygiene and just overall making sure that stressors are dealt with, et cetera, during the day so that the person can get into the bed feeling nice, calm, cool, and relaxed.
So it seems to be with sleep hygiene, you know, there's a list of the do's and don'ts, but as individuals, we probably have different responses to the different practices. Do you find that you need to kind of pay attention to all of them, or is it that you find the ones that seem to be the most impactful and be very stringent on those?
So we tend to tell people at the beginning that we're going to attack this sleep problem from every angle because we want the treatment to be effective. And then what ends up happening is people sometimes can allow a little bit of things back in that they say, well, you know what? I did realize that I can't have any caffeine whatsoever. I can't even have my morning coffee because it affects me. And someone else can say, you know what? I'm able to see that I can go up to about 8 hours before and I can have just a little bit of a pick me up and I'm still okay. So people start kind of individualizing it. Similarly, I definitely have people who fight me with regard to the reading or watching TV in bed. Some people will say, but that actually puts me to sleep. That keeps me relaxed. So again, we start off really trying to do everything and then see if that person is able to have those things in their life, if it incorporates it, if it works for them or not. But I will emphasize that electronics in the bed or before bedtime have been so well documented and well researched now to be negatively impacting the ability to sleep that I'm very strict on the electronics.
Okay, that's good. And what about the role of relaxation?
So I just always tell people that you cannot be anxious and relaxed at the same time. And most people who complain to me that they have trouble sleeping are experiencing some level of anxiety. Now, some people have anxiety that's throughout the day and may be caused by various factors, and other people do not. Other people only have anxiety about sleep. This has been a problem for them. It's being maintained by the different behaviors that they have during the day and that they're maintaining. So they get in a bed and suddenly that anxiety comes in. They're saying, how many hours am I going to get tonight? Uh-oh, I'm looking, you know, at the clock every 5 minutes. I'm getting more and more frustrated. So that's why it's so important for a person to practice relaxation exercises, deep breathing, meditation, doing scripted exercises, and make sure that they find ways to relax before getting into bed.
So I remember hearing once someone saying that some people find some relaxation exercises. The one example they gave was the progressive relaxation, where you kind of go from head to toe, relaxing the parts of your body. For some people, actually creating kind of an anxiety response. And I think I've experienced that myself. Have you found that at all in your practice?
So it's funny because out of all the relaxation exercises that I recommend, the progressive muscle one is actually my least favorite. That's just a personal kind of thing. I don't like the tensing up of the muscles first and then relaxing them. So I prefer one that I have in my book and that I give to my patients as an audio, which is just relaxing as much as you can and very focused on the breathing. One thing that I will say about what you mentioned or what you ask with becoming more anxious is that many people think that they can just all of a sudden try a relaxation exercise in the middle of feeling very anxious and that it's supposed to work for them. And then when it doesn't work, they say, see, it didn't help me at all. I'm not doing this anymore. And the problem is that they've never practiced it. So like anything else, practice makes perfect. And it's so important that a person who wants to utilize relaxation exercises and really benefit from them must practice them during the day at a time when they are not feeling particularly anxious if they want it to be helpful for them when they are.
Are you new to podcasts? The most convenient way to listen is through a podcast app available on all smartphones. Podcast apps download each episode automatically, so they are available whenever and wherever you want. Find out how to find an app and subscribe by going to sleeptohealthy.com and click on the relevant button. Yeah, I actually use a app called Headspace, and they have an anxiety module. And that's probably my most effective method that I've found so far. What about stimulus control? What can you tell us about that?
Stimulus control is essentially saying, get up out of bed when you cannot sleep. And the reason for that is because a person that remains in bed when they cannot sleep is reinforcing a conditioning that the mind has with the bed of, this is a horrible place. I cannot sleep well. And every time I get into bed, it's worse and worse. So by remaining in the bed when awake, it's just maintaining that negative association with the bed. Now by getting up out of bed, going into another room, doing something either boring or relaxing until you feel calm and sleepy again. By doing that, by getting up out of bed, it starts to redefine the bed and the conditioning that the person has and make it a more positive association.
In one of the chapters of the book, you start off with a story about a person having sleep issues, and they were worried about not getting enough sleep and not being able to get to sleep. So they would get to go to bed earlier and earlier in order to give them more time to go to sleep, and that was not helping. Can you tell us about the role of sleep restriction?
So sleep restriction is actually the nuts and bolts of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. It is what really works. So how sleep restriction helps a person is that in treatment, a person first is going to be keeping sleep logs. They're going to be keeping track of how many hours they are sleeping on a nightly basis. After at least 1 week, I mean, some people will do more, a couple of weeks, but after a minimum of 1 week, we add up the averages that the person has for their sleep at night, and we restrict the amount of time they are allowed to be in the bed to that number. So for example, if a person is averaging 6 hours of sleep per night, then we'll say, okay, so your new bedtime is going to be midnight, wake up time, 6 a.m. How's that work for you? You know, we work together to figure out the best bedtime and wake time, but it's going to be using that average that the person already had. Now, I get a lot of resistance on sleep restriction, as you can probably imagine, especially since some people that are coming in have very, very low nightly averages. Now, I don't restrict below 5 hours per night. However, even for people, like I had a gentleman yesterday and he was fighting me on 7.5 hours. And I said, but this isn't really sleep restriction, 7.5 hours. But for him, he was feeling like it was because this was a person who was spending 11 hours in the bed at night and only getting 6 hours of sleep. So we've been slowly restricting the amount of time that he's in the bed, and he's already seeing vast improvement. So what it does is it makes it that the person's sleep will become consolidated and they will have less time lying in the bed awake. So once again, we're combining it with that stimulus control where the person's getting up out of bed where they can't sleep. Now we're limiting the amount of time that they actually can be in the bed, and they're going to get in a bed. They're going to fall asleep quicker and hopefully sleep straight through. That's what we want to be doing, consolidating the sleep.
I think that's a good example, too, of how, as we talked earlier on about CBTI taking commitment and maybe willing to go through some discomfort in order to reap the benefits of it. I've used sleep restriction, but not in the formal sense in terms of keeping a log and making, sticking to strict hours. But one of the things I've learned is that when I wake up in the morning, that I'll get up at my set time regardless of how I feel. It used to be if I woke up and I thought, oh, I didn't sleep that well, I'm going to sleep in, because I'm semi-retired, so I get that luxury sometimes. But now I don't do that, and I find that overall my sleep is much better if I'm just willing to get myself out of bed, even though I'm not feeling like I should for that particular morning. And can you talk a little bit more about sleep logs? Do you encourage those? When do you get people to use sleep logs?
Sleep logs are really important because we start to see patterns and we start to see what really does affect a person's sleep. So a lot of times when a person comes to me for the first time in that initial session, they tell me that they can't control their sleep at all. They don't know when they're going to have a good night versus a bad night. Nothing they do during the day affects it. Absolutely nothing. So when we start to keep the sleep logs, we start to see, but look, this day you exercised and you were really active and you met friends for lunch. And then you went and you volunteered at the animal shelter. And then you went and picked your grandkids up, after school, and you had a busy day and look how well you slept. And the next day, well, okay, you had a doctor's appointment and looks like you maybe watched some TV. You catnapped a little bit throughout the day. So these kind of things we look at and we see patterns and we say, now we can identify factors for that particular individual of what impacts their sleep and what doesn't. And I actually love it when people come into me and they say, look, I know why I slept really badly last night. It was because I was so stressed out. I was thinking about X, Y, and Z. And it just makes me so happy because they're no longer saying things like, I can't control my sleep at all. It's beyond me. This keeping sleep logs and the whole process of CBTI is so empowering. And so it helps a person to see they are in control and they can make particular changes in their sleep.
Okay, so that kind of exhausts my lists of the main components of CBTI. Have I missed anything out? Is there anything else you would like to say about it?
Just the only other component I would add in is that for some people, they do have that really high level of anxiety. And so we have to address those irrational types of thoughts, fears, et cetera, that are occurring during the day. And if we can deal with some of that during the day, then it's going to help a person a lot at night. So not everybody requires as much of that. Some people really benefit just from more of the behavioral aspects. Like I said, with the sleep restriction, stimulus control, relaxation, all of that, the sleep hygiene. But some people really do have a stronger anxiety component, and they require a bit more cognitive work.
Yeah, and I think for personally, that's kind of where my starting point was dealing with those irrational beliefs that was creating anxiety that was causing insomnia. If someone was to try CBTI, how would you suggest they get started?
So I would suggest that they look for a board certified provider in their area, a clinician in their area. Most major cities have sleep labs and probably have people that they could refer to. Now, a person with insomnia typically does not need a sleep study, so they're not going in for that reason. But they would go in order to get a referral or a resource for somebody. And there are certainly things like the American Board of Sleep Medicine that lists providers, and just even doing a Google search can probably set the person up in the right direction, but they want to go to somebody who has that expertise in sleep.
And do you have any suggestions on how to use your book for best effect?
So I think that it's really important to truly work through it. It is a workbook, so it's intended to be very hands-on and active rather than other books that you just passively read. So by doing the worksheets, by filling out the inventories, by really going through this book, it can be extremely effective for people to resolve their sleep issues. But it does, once again, take a lot of hard work and dedication on the part of the individual. And a lot of times I'll even have people that will come into me and they'll say, I love your book. It's great, but I just needed a little bit more help. I just need someone to push me. Because, for example, doing the sleep restriction all by yourself can be difficult. But when a clinician is telling you, this is what we're going to do this time to this time, and you're coming back next week, and I want to see what your sleep logs look like, you're usually a little more, held a little more accountable, and the process can be somewhat easier then.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a cliche that you get out what you put in, but I definitely think that's true. And if you're willing to actually take the time to write things out and think them through, you're going to benefit a lot more than just reading it through and not doing the work. So as we near the end here, I have a fun but serious question for you. So in my fantasy world, I'm a YouTube wizard who is giving you unlimited resources to produce a 30-second video. And in addition, my marketing wizards will guarantee a minimum of 10 million views of your video. So what would you put in that video?
Well, I think that I would have in this video a superwoman who comes in and knocks out all of these sleeping pills and pharmaceutical industry and tells people, don't give up hope. You absolutely can find that wonderful sleep on your own, that it is a process. It does take work, but there are so many ways to improve your sleep and to take control of it. And it does not require taking a sleeping pill. So I think I would just really emphasize that component of how wonderful it feels and how empowering it is for an individual, and how much better medication-free sleep actually feels to an individual. Because that's the thing that I hear over and over again, that people will tell me, wow, I just didn't know I could get this quality of sleep again, because now I'm finally off the meds and I'm sleeping on my own.
Well, that's great. Thanks very much, Superwoman. And as we wrap up, what's one thing that our listeners could do today to improve their sleep tonight so they could feel better tomorrow?
Put away the electronics before bedtime.
Yeah, we hear that a lot now. That's good.
We do. And for anybody out there who's listening who has teenagers, or really children at this point at any age, to get them to take it away too. Make sure that you're taking those devices out of their rooms at nighttime. Don't allow them to be charged in the room at night, because it's just too enticing for kids. If they're having hearing beeps coming through, they're going to be looking at their phone over and over again, and it keeps people awake. So we all need a reminder to just put those electronics away and be able to relax our minds in a natural way.
Yeah, cell phones came into being kind of partway through my parenting, and I would say that's one of the, I'd actually say, few regrets that I have about parenting, is I didn't take those cell phones away at night, and they ended up using them in their bedroom, and I definitely would do things differently now. Yeah. And where should people go to learn more about you and the resources you have available?
Well, my website is sleeppsychology.com. So that's www.sleeppsychology, S-L-E-E-P, PSYCHOLOGY.com. And on there, I do list some resources and some sleep tips for individuals and ways that they can get in contact with me should they want to.
That's great. And as always, we'll have the links to Dr. Silberman's website and the book in the show notes at sleepthehealthy.com. So, Dr. Silberman, you gave us a lot of information to digest today. Thank you for authoring a book with in-depth information combined with a workbook, so we have something tangible to work on to improve our sleep. On behalf of our listeners, thank you for being with us today and giving us a viable option to improve our sleep and well-being.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Let's see if we can pull out some gems from today's episode. One thing that struck me was Dr. Silberman's comment that the core of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is sleep restriction therapy. In the media, we hear mainly about quantity, how many hours to get. But she is saying that it's more important to focus on quality. Restrict your sleep until you're getting high-quality sleep, then ease up and maintain the quality. When you think about it, this is the same for developing any skill. You need to practice towards perfection, not continue to practice your bad habits. Perhaps the second is to not give up hope. We've heard this same theme from other guests, and we'll hear it again in the future. The Sleep to Healthy podcast tries to present many different perspectives and methods for improving sleep. So if you're still struggling with sleep, keep on listening. The final gem is the role of sleeping pills and sleep. Dr. Silberman is a board-certified sleep medicine specialist, so when she recommends that we use sleeping pills as a temporary measure only, we should probably be listening. The alternatives are not going to be as convenient as handing over some cash and popping the pills, but the result will be worth it. As always, you can find detailed show notes about the interview with Dr. Silberman, along with all the links at sleepthehealthy.com. And this concludes our episode for today. Other episodes related to today's topic include Episode 9 with Michael Schwartz, titled Sleep on Demand, where he discusses intensive sleep retraining. Our next episode, Episode 11, with Dr. Wallace Mendelson, titled Sleeping Pills, where he covers the role of sleeping pills and their benefits and risks. And you might also find episode 12 with Dr. James Alexander helpful. If you're looking for some fresh and effective methods to improve your sleep, Dr. Alexander will not disappoint. Thank you for keeping me company today. I look forward to you joining me on our next episode of the Sleep to Healthy podcast. This podcast is not a substitute for advice from a qualified healthcare professional. The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and entertain. As we do not know your particulars, we cannot and do not provide professional or medical advice or services. We'd strongly encourage you to consult a healthcare professional before incorporating any ideas from this podcast. Listeners who use the information in this podcast do so at their own risk. The guests on this podcast express their own opinions, beliefs, and conclusions, which is neither supported nor opposed by the podcast and host. The podcast does not fact check information provided.